This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Why are some people rich and others poor? Tackling this elusive question has been the lifelong work of economist William Sandy Darity. Sandy was an observant and precocious child. From an early age, he picked up on how wealth disparities divided communities. He grew up abroad, where his father worked for the World Health Organization. And in Alexandria, Egypt, he saw how the same beachfront looked dramatically different at points along the coast based on which communities had access. He saw similar divides in his grandparents' hometown of Wilson, North Carolina. The railroad tracks split the city in half, creating two separate worlds. He carried these experiences with him into his career and helped pioneer the field of stratification economics. It looks at how things like privilege, race, and class affect wealth building. Sandy Darity is director of the Samuel Dubois Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke University, and he joins me now. Welcome back, Sandy Darity. Good to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
I am desperate to get into your work because I find it infinitely fascinating, but I do want you to take us back a little bit and tell us about your background because you've got roots here in North Carolina.
Yeah, both of my parents are from North Carolina. My father, William Darity. My mother, Evangeline Royal. My father is from a small town in the mountains called East Flat Rock. Not that there's a West Flat Rock. and my mother is from Wilson, North Carolina, which is probably a more familiar city to most people in the state.
They've made, in the case of your parents, they both made big jumps in terms of their social position, right?
Right. So if we talk about the phenomenon of social mobility or upward mobility, it's my parents who were the ones who made a transition to what we may refer to as middle class status. My father went to Shaw University ultimately and then did a master's degree at North Carolina Central and then a PhD in public health at UNC. My mother eventually earned a PhD in education from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, but she did her undergraduate work at Barbara Scotia College. So we are a very North Carolina-centered family.
You talked about your father's work in public health, which eventually led to a job at the World Health Organization and meant that you were on the road from the age of about 6 months, right?
Yeah, and when I was 6 months old, we actually moved to Beirut, Lebanon, where we lived for 5 years, and then we moved to Alexandria, Egypt, where we lived for the next 3 years of my life. So the first 8 years of my life essentially were in the Middle East.
And I made reference in the introduction to
And my sister was actually born in Beirut, Lebanon.
So there you are. So really not so much familiarity with how things were in the United States of America in those days in terms of social mobility or any of the questions that we're going to talk about.
Well, every 2 years, the World Health Organization would give us essentially a quasi-leave or vacation. And so we'd come back to the States. And so I think, from the time I was about 2 years of age, I had a connection with life in North Carolina. Now, it wasn't a day-to-day connection, but by the time we moved back to the States permanently when I was 8 years of age, when my father entered graduate school at UNC, I think I had a pretty good understanding of what the circumstances were here.
Well, tell us about that and this, maybe your observations in Wilson, for instance, and how the tracks divided that town.
Well, the tracks divided the town between black and white folks, which is kind of the classic pattern in many southern towns. And it was very clear, too, that there were different styles of living on each side of the tracks, which was associated very heavily with the amount of resources that people had. So you did have stratification among whites, and you had stratification among blacks. So there was a black middle class that lived on the black side of the tracks. But the resources that the black middle class had were not really comparable to the resources that were held by folks who were in the middle class in the white community. And so so you did have variation or stratification in both communities, but the patterns of stratification tended to leave black folks with less.
That was probably not the language you were using at 8 years old to describe what you were seeing. How did you take all that in at the age of eight?
I'm not sure what the language is I would have used at the time, but I had a sense that there was something that was unfair about this, something that wasn't right about it. I remember wanting to go see a movie at a local theater in Wilson. It was a Disney movie that was widely advertised on television. I don't remember exactly which one, but I wanted to go see it. And my parents wouldn't let me go because it was being shown at a movie theater where black folks had to sit in the balcony. And so my folks didn't accept the idea of sitting in the balcony. They just wouldn't go at all. And they wouldn't let me go. And I had a hard time understanding that. But, when I was a bit older, I had a deeper sense of how they were resisting this whole process.
Well, I also talked in the introduction about your observations on those beaches, those beachfronts in Alexandria. Tell us about that. And again, what was going through your mind?
So we had friends who kind of crossed the boundaries of the class structure in Egypt. I wouldn't have used the language class structure, but I did have a sense that that some of our friends were better positioned within Egyptian society. In fact, a couple of my close friends' parents were military officers, which was a relatively high status position in the context of Egypt at that time. But there were also friends of ours who worked as domestics. And so when I was with the friends who worked as domestics, we would go to what I visualize as the left end of the corniche. Mm. But when I was with the friends who were whose fathers were military officers, we would go to the right end of the corniche. And I became aware, because of the crowdedness, because of the lack of cleanliness, et cetera, because of the sheer number of people, that these ends of the beach were very, very different places. And it was also very clear to me that the folks who had less were on the left end of the corniche, and the folks who had more were on the right end of the corniche.
Of course, these kind of observations are inescapable for any of us. But then the question for me is, when does it become a question for you? When does it become sort of when does the giant why pop into your head?
So I think the giant why pops into my head when I reach my teen years. Mm. I think that's right. Always sort of reconstructing your personal history right. when you're somebody who's in your 60s becomes kind of hard. But, yeah, I think it was in my teen years.
Because that's an important moment, because there are narratives that allow you to sort of absorb this without questioning, simple narratives about merit and effort and all these kinds of things that, if you absorb them and never think them through, you don't – that's your explanation. But at a certain point, people like you will say, well, now, hang on a second. They work awfully hard. Why is it that they're working four times as hard, really burning more calories than this guy who owns the house?
Yeah, so I definitely had a sense that from an early age that you couldn't explain these kinds of differences on the basis of merit, that it seemed fairly clear that the folks who had less were born with less and the folks who had more were born with more on average. And also, I think an important dimension of this was my parents, who had made a transition from being from comparatively poor families to being in a position to give me a relatively comfortable life, never took the position that their accomplishments were entirely attributable to their own independent activities. I mean, they always made it clear that there were folks who had supported them along the way, people who had intervened at important stages in their lives that made it possible for them to make the kind of transition that they took. And so I think it was also important that my parents never said that these kinds of patterns that I was observing were due to intrinsic merit or effort, but that they had a very clear sense that in some ways, folks who made the transition from poverty to an improved economic status, that there was some luck or good fortune that was involved, that was something that also had to accompany any effort that the individual made.
And were they politically active? I mean, obviously, your father spent some time abroad. Did they talk about the situation here in the U.S.?
Oh, yeah, quite often. I remember they would take me to the movie theaters to see the newsreels so that I could have some sense of what was taking place in the United States. I have a distinct memory of being taken to see the newsreel of President Kennedy's inaugural address. Mm. In 1960. Yeah. So I think, you know, my parents made a special effort to keep both my sister and I well informed about what they perceived was happening in the United States.
That information led to a career as an economist teaching at Duke University. William Sandy Darity is director of the Samuel Dubois Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke, and we'll continue our conversation with him on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Sandy Darity this hour, Duke Professor of Public Policy, African and African American Studies and Economics, directs the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity. We're talking a little bit about growing up and moving between North Carolina and an international career for your father with the World Health Organization. You went to Glenwood Elementary School in Chapel Hill. Tell us about that experience.
So we moved to Chapel Hill in 1961, if I recall correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And my father was in the PhD program in health education at UNC School of Public Health. And at the time, graduate students who had families lived in what was called Victory Village. It's now known as Odom Village, I believe. Mm. And I remember exactly where we lived, 610B Hibbert Street or something like that. And we lived in an apartment that was shared with a variety of folks who were also graduate students who had families. And there was an issue that arose over where I would go to school, because in 1961, there was a dual school system in operation still in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. But what was interesting was that the kids who lived in Victory Village were all assigned to go to Glenwood Elementary. And so there was one other black family whose parent was a graduate student at UNC, and they had a son also. And so ultimately the decision was made that the two of us would go to the school that we were districted to go to. And so, in effect, we desegregated Glenwood Elementary before there was extensive desegregation of the schools in Chapel Hill.
Well, tell us how that worked out for you.
We were the two black kids in the school. We weren't in the same grade, and so we typically did not see very much of one another during the course of the day. Generally, my experience was okay. There were a couple of teachers who were somewhat hostile. There were some students who were hostile, and the hostility became more pronounced during the period where there was a gubernatorial election in North Carolina. And there was an incident on the school bus one day where a kid called me the N-word, and so I hit him. And then I was called into the office. My parents came, but my parents said, well, you know, that's what we told him to do. And so I survived that incident. Yeah. But generally, I did have some very warm friendships that I developed. And I think my closest friend was a guy named Jay Deshpande, whose father was, his father had just completed his PhD at UNC. And I think then they left Chapel Hill about 2 years after I started school. But he was a great friend.
Now, I wonder what the conversations were like between you and your father, because if I've got it right, you say he was getting his PhD. Was he the first African-American who got a PhD, or among the first to get a PhD from UNC?
So I think I like to say he's the first known black recipient of a PhD at UNC. Yeah, and so he's identified as such. And so he finished in essentially in about 2 years, between 61 and 63, and then took a job with the North Carolina Fund. But because of the intensity of his work as a graduate student and to finish in 2 years, you know, my mother was the one who spent most of the time being the person who was the parent who really raised us during that interval of time. And she was politically active. She was very active in the civil rights movement in the Chapel Hill, Raleigh, Durham area. And so she used to take my sister and I on marches with her.
Did you have the sense then that, again, we're talking about elementary school, so you know, it's hard to look back, but I wonder if you had the sense at the time that you were doing something important, that this was an important a kind of mission you were on and you would have to endure whatever, or not, or just get me out of here. I wonder what was how you looked at it.
So I think I did have a sense that there was something a little odd about being only one of two black kids in a school in a town like Chapel Hill. But because of my overseas experience, I had not really gone to school with a significant number of black kids, especially black American kids. And so I was somewhat used to being kind of the unusual kid in a school. Because, for example, in Egypt, you know, I was the only American student at an English-speaking Egyptian school. So that didn't prove to be something that really bothered me deeply in that way. But it was a little bit strange.
Yeah.
It was a little bit strange, particularly because I knew that there was a fairly significant black community in Chapel Hill.
And again, didn't have access. So I think these are some of the themes we're going to talk about in
so,
just a few
so
minutes.
So actually, there was access and friendships that developed because I would occasionally go to, what was it called, the Robeson Street? Recreation park had a swimming pool, and you know, I'd spend a lot of time in the summer there, and that was a site where I could interact with a significant number of black kids who I wasn't going to school with. But by 64, 65, then they undertook comprehensive desegregation of the Chapel Hill schools, and so when I went to Phillips Junior High, that was the first time I'd been in school with a significant number of black kids at the same time.
But again, this could be fuel for thoughts about why didn't everybody have access and how is it that you were there? You understood why you were there, but why isn't everybody? So you go. Eventually, the family moves to Massachusetts, and you get involved in a program called A Better Chance. Tell us about that.
Well, I wasn't involved in it, but Amherst, Massachusetts, Amherst Regional High School was one of the sites that was selected as a location for the students who were in the A Better Chance program. The Better Chance program was predicated on moving kids largely from inner city neighborhoods where they presumably were going to schools that were not going to be as challenging or effective for them, and moving them either to prep schools or to Tony public schools. And so Amherst Regional High School was one of the seemingly prestigious public high schools that was a site for the A Better Chance program. And so what was significant about that was all of the kids in the ABC program, as it was called, were black males who were largely from urban areas in the United States. And there was a very, very small black population of students at Amherst Regional. And when these guys came, there still was a small black population, but their presence really changed the dynamic. And, you know, it was actually terrific for me because, you know, I had the opportunity to develop some friendships that I would not otherwise have had the chance to develop. Yeah.
When did you decide to pursue economics?
When I was an undergraduate at Brown University, I thought about what I wanted to do afterwards, as most undergraduates do. And everyone thought I would become a lawyer, I think because I was actually somewhat successful in debate. But I wasn't interested in being a lawyer because one thing I'd learned from debate is that you can construct persuasive arguments on either side of an issue, but both sides of the issue are not necessarily correct. And so I concluded after having just a really, really interesting time in a political science class in a section that was led by a faculty member named Ira Strauber. Actually, he was a graduate student at the time. He's now been on the faculty at Grinnell College for many years. But he taught a section of the Introduction to Political Science, and he gave us additional readings beyond the ones that were assigned for the course by the regular faculty. And I discovered early on that I enjoyed critiquing the readings, that it, you know, I was not inclined to just spit back the content, but I was, you know, investing a substantial amount of time in just thinking about what was really being said here, whether it was right, what made me feel uncomfortable about particular passages. And so it was at that stage in some conversations with Ira Strauber that he and I concluded that I was probably better off becoming an academic.
That kind of thinking makes it really hard to get through school, doesn't it?
Yeah.
just take it. But you didn't. And it was economics, too, and not political science. So tell us about that.
Yeah. So I decided to do economics because I was interested in a fundamental way in economic inequality. So I thought economics would be the discipline where I could get the best insights about that, you know, going back to these questions that had been burning for me since early childhood. I started taking economics classes, and then I discovered that I didn't really like the answers that the economists provided. And so with the hubris of youth, I decided I would become an economist and try to change the way economists thought about things. You know, obviously, that has not happened.
No, but your work allows us to see things in ways that we wouldn't have.
And I do think that the work that I've done has actually had an impact, not just in the academic setting, but in the public policy arena. So, yeah, I'm actually very pleased with the decision that I made, but I think that I was overly ambitious as an undergraduate.
That's the way it should be, especially if you're going into economics. Dream big, because otherwise it's just the marginal value of utility or something. Let's talk about a little bit about your dissertation, though, because that was something that looked at how the slave trade and slavery shaped inequalities today. And this was groundbreaking research at the time in some ways.
Yeah, I was a graduate student at MIT in economics, and one of the intrinsic features of graduate study at MIT is the emphasis on teaching you how to do mathematical models of social phenomena. And so I think what was innovative about one of the chapters of my dissertation was that I actually constructed a mathematical model of the Atlantic slave trade to try to explore what were the conditions or circumstances under which we could get a division in the world between rich and poor countries or rich and poor peoples. And so I think that was somewhat unique. I took the work of Eric Williams in Capitalism and Slavery. I took the work of Walter Rodney in How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. I took the work from C.L.R. James in his book, The Black Jacobins, and I tried to transform all of that into a model that might generate a certain set of results that I think were consistent with their hypotheses.
Right, and part of this is not to look back, not so much to simply look back and say, what role did slavery play in the political and social and economic structures of the time, but to see how it's carried forward and how the structures and economic system and financial structures, banking structure today is very much dependent on those. So it hasn't gone away is the point.
Yeah, the language I was using at the time, and it's not original to me, I was studying what I'd like to refer to as uneven development. And, you know, what are the causes of uneven development and what leads to the persistence of uneven development.
You talked about being at MIT, but there was a moment that you were thinking about Harvard. You didn't go there, and there's a story behind that.
Oh, okay. yeah, you have a lot of information here.
I do. And it's my job to make you talk, Sandy.
So there was a program at Harvard that was called the doctoral program in political economy. And because I had done political science as an undergraduate, actually I'd probably taken more classes in political science than I did in economics, but I was a double concentrator. I thought it might be very, very interesting and actually fun to do a program that actually merged training in economics with training in political science. And so I had applied to that program also, and I went there for an interview. And when I walk in the door, the gentleman says to me, the professor, he says to me, "Oh, you're the young man from Dartmouth." Well, actually, I had never attended Dartmouth College. And my father said something to me, which I think is probably correct, but it's a little bit, it's a little bit derogatory towards Dartmouth, but
it's okay. We're here. They're not listening.
But yeah, no, the whole audience is not listening.
Yeah.
No. But he said that there was a prior belief that to some degree, the easiest program to traverse out of the so-called Ivies was probably Dartmouth. And so when he saw that I was a black scholar coming in, applying for this program, he just assumed that that's where I was going. And that presumption probably is not valid, but that's how my father interpreted what
was
happening.
But you took it.
But it put me off.
Yeah.
And so you know, so I didn't accept their offer when they admitted me. So I went to
MIT, where you did learn, again, those mathematical models, which have served you well in your career. Eventually, you went to UT Austin, taught there for a while, met your wife.
Yes. Yeah, I met Kirsten Mullen at the University of Texas at Austin. We met in the Perry Castaneda Library. And
I think that's where two scholars should meet, don't you?
The rest is history.
And eventually came back to North Carolina and became one of the pioneers in the economic subfield of stratification. Am I right?
Yeah. I think I don't want to claim that I designed stratification economics, and I certainly haven't worked independently. There's a number of scholars, especially Derek Hamilton at the New School, James Stewart at Penn State, Marie Mora and Alberto Davila at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. There's a group of scholars who have worked on the development of stratification economics. And I think there are elements of what I'm calling stratification economics that are present in earlier work by both economists and sociologists. I'd especially highlight Herbert Bloomer in the field of sociology, Thorsten Veblen in economics, but they didn't call it that.
Right.
And so I think I'm the person who named it.
Well,
and
what is the it? Give us a brief description.
So the central idea in stratification economics is that individuals have alliances not only to themselves, which is, I guess, the way in which much of standard economics proceeds, but they have group affiliations. And the strength of these group affiliations can vary. But among their stronger group affiliations, they have deep concerns about how well their group is doing in comparison with other groups. And so in Veblen's work, initially, he talks about tribal communities that conquer others and render the other tribal community subordinate to them and establish a position of superiority vis-a-vis that other tribal community. And he argues that this is something that's valued by the members of the dominant group. And so you get two sets of comparisons that ultimately are being made. One set of comparison is my group versus yours. But the other comparisons are within-group comparisons. So how am I doing in comparison with other folks who are members of my own group?
We'll talk more about that when my conversation with Sandy Darity, an economist and scholar at Duke University, continues on The State of Things. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with economist Sandy Darity, who directs the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke University. We're talking about an economic theory that opens our eyes to the value that we place on the group that we perceive ourselves. Of course, classic economic capitalist theory says each one of us as an individual is kind of maximizing our gain and our benefit in the system. But what you're looking at and others is the fact that we also have group identifications, and making sure that group maintains its privilege becomes important.
Yeah. And I think that the critical thing about that is we have to establish how much weight individuals give to the comparisons that they're making across groups versus the comparisons that they're making within their social group. And both matter. And I think that what stratification economics does is it permits us to look at both of those kinds of processes of comparison making. The key separation with the way in which conventional economics has operated is conventional economics has emphasized people's absolute position, but stratification economics focuses heavily on relative position. And I think it's insights from stratification economics that would perhaps better help us understand what happened in the most recent election, where I think that relative racial position was a key factor determining how many white voters chose to
So what would be the thinking? Show us how this would work and play out in terms of the mind of the voter.
So whether or not this is actually true, as long as individuals perceive that their racial group is threatened or that its position, its preferred position is being undermined in some way, then they can respond by trying to put somebody in power who they believe will preserve their group's position or extend it. And so if you have coded, semi-coded language like make America great again, that signals one message to communities who have been subjected to years and years of oppression. And it signals another message to a group that may feel that their racially preferred position is in jeopardy. And so so I think that we have to think about the value or weight that people place on relative group position to better understand some of the political dynamics that we've observed recently.
What's interesting about this is the way that it integrates behavioral sciences with economics and some of the models that you show and have worked with to show how wealth development over time has an impact. And so all of this raises serious questions about the American dream, whether or not I can start from nothing and work my way to the top in this system. It's a level playing field for all of us. And your work suggests it's really not.
Yeah, I assume there are some people out there who have gone from having very, very little to having a lot.
Yeah.
But I think that their cases are extremely rare, that for most people, the dice are loaded in one direction or the other. And if we think about racial differences, I think we have to explain huge differences in wealth primarily on the basis of the resources that a past generation can move on to a younger generation. And because Black Americans were denied access to wealth for so long, and in fact, Black Americans were wealth under slavery. So because the Black Americans have been denied wealth for so very long, then it's extremely difficult for any amount of significant transfers to be made from the older generation to the younger generation. And so this becomes manifest in facts or observations like blacks having $1 in net worth at the median for every $15 or $16 that are held by white Americans. It's also manifest in the fact that blacks with a college degree have 2/3 of the net worth of whites who never finished high school. So if we start thinking about group differences and group advantages and disadvantages, privileges and deprivations, and relative group position in particular, it becomes very, very informative in thinking about why we have these huge disparities.
Those statistics are tantalizing, and the correlation is something you can't ignore. To what extent can we demonstrate that this is because of historic racism that this wealth divide continues today and not something to do with effort or ability?
So for one thing, we know from research that was done by a couple of economists named Ed Wolf and Norman Gittleman that if you take into account the level of income of a household, blacks and whites have no significant difference in savings rates. So, and in fact, in some income categories, blacks actually have a higher savings rate than whites. And there's no difference in rates of return on portfolios, again, once you take into account household income. And so so we can't assert that these huge differences that we're observing are attributable to blacks being more profligate than whites. So something else has to be going on. And I think that increasingly the work that's being done through our research team at the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity is demonstrating that the key factor is intergenerational effects. Intergenerational transfers of resources that determine the wealth levels of the current generation.
Right, and you have to make a key distinction here, an important distinction between wealth and income.
Yes.
Right. This is not about having jobs. This is about being able to invest so that your money is going to work for you, owning things.
Right. So wealth is the difference between the value of what you own and what you owe. We also refer to it as net worth. And it's a stock concept. That is, it's a stock of accumulated resources, the difference between the value of your assets and the value of your debts. And this is different from income, which is a flow primarily associated for most people with their earnings. Yeah.
So, and this is demonstrated in other ways, and you've done some important work on this, particularly in education. Of course, the correlation between education and wealth is also fairly well documented, although, again, there are disparities along racial lines. But you did a study that looked at how the channeling and misidentification, how much of it happens right at the elementary school level. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this was almost 20 years ago, I guess. There was a study I did for the state's Department of Public Instruction. I did it in conjunction or collaboration with Carolyn Tyson, who was at UNC at Chapel Hill. And we examined the participation in what we identified as more challenging curriculum on the part of Black and Native American students. At the time, there was not a significant presence of Latino students in the state schools. But, of course, that's different now. And what we discovered was there was gross underrepresentation of Black and Native American kids in curricula that we marked as being more challenging. So this would include gifted and talented programs at the elementary and middle school stage, honors classes at the middle school stage, and then advanced placement, international baccalaureate, or honors classes at the high school level. In contrast, Black and Native American kids were grossly overrepresented in classes that we might be identify as being marked off for slow learners. So there are these dramatic differences in terms of the pattern of where Black and Native American students are located in comparison with students from other ethnic groups. And we referred to that as racialized tracking, and have argued that if we are truly concerned about what we refer to as the racial achievement gap, that's the core point. Right. Where that has to be attacked, that you have to alter the curriculum and instruction that's being received by the kids who are comparatively lower performers.
And as part of the survey, you went in and sort of did some retesting and found out that these kids, many of these kids were simply misplaced. So it wasn't that they were, that's where they belong. They didn't belong there. That's why those numbers were.
Well, we didn't actually do the retesting, but we did look at data that included information about test performance of the kids. And we could identify kids who appear to be placed incorrectly on the basis of their test score performance.
So what do we do about it? How do we address this gap and bring things back into balance?
So I'd like to mention some other things in a moment, but let me answer this question. The way we do this is we detrack, and my preferred route towards detracking is to detract toward excellence for all students. So what I would like to see us do is have a universal strategy of the provision of gifted quality education to all students. And there is an initiative that was developed in North Carolina, partially in reaction to the report that we had done in 2001, that led to the development of a program called Project Bright Idea. And the premise behind Project Bright Idea is to intervene by providing teachers with an opportunity to address their own dispositions and to give them the capacity to provide gifted quality education for all the kids in a classroom. And so I think that's the direction that has to be taken, is to give all students a challenging high-level curriculum. So let's eliminate tracking, but not eliminate excellence.
Right.
Yeah.
What about the wealth gap? I mean, again, how do we get past that? If historic patterns have led us here, what do we do to undo it?
So my wife, Kirsten Mullen, and I are working on a book now on reparations for African Americans. So if we're very concerned about the racial wealth gap, I think that the way in which that has to be addressed is through a program of reparations. But we can also generally attack wealth inequality by introducing something like a program that Derek Hamilton and I have talked about, which we refer to as the Baby Bonds Project. Mm-hmm. It's not actually a bond at all. It's an endowment or a trust fund that would be provided to each newborn infant, and the amount of the trust fund would be contingent upon the wealth position of their families. And so if a child is born into the wealthiest families in the United States, we'd give them a $50 trust fund. But for kids born into the families that are most wealth poor, we'd give them a $50,000 to $60,000 trust fund. The kids could access this when they reach adulthood. It's possible that we might place constraints on what they could use the funds mm-hmm. for, since it's public money. But the idea would be to directly attack the intergenerational disadvantage or advantage that's held by particular children, by making sure that all children have a resource base in terms of an asset that they can convert into future wealth.
All right. And now that does sound like it would run afoul of much of the current political thinking these days. The idea of using public money to hand to people sounds like a political challenge these days.
Well, it's a political challenge in this moment. I think that one thing that is a possibility is we might be able to identify a local community or a local municipality that might try to run this type of project on a demonstration basis. Mm-hmm. And so if the opportunity arises at a later point to do something more dramatic at the federal level, then we could say, well, we've got evidence that this really does work.
You also talk about a job guarantee.
Yeah. So for a number of years, I've argued that and in fact, I even argued for this immediately at the point of the onset of the Great Recession, that what we should have in place in the United States is a guarantee of employment for all Americans. This is not an entirely new idea at all. It was present in Franklin Roosevelt's Economic Bill of Rights. But the premise is that we would replicate some of the things that were done under the aegis of the Works Progress Administration and the Civilian Conservation Corps in the 1930s in such a way that we would ensure that every American would have the opportunity to get employment at non-poverty wages. And so this would include the provision of certain benefits, and one of the benefits would be the same type of medical insurance that's provided to all civil servants and federal officials. But the idea here is that we would eliminate the threat of unemployment for all Americans. And as I've said, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, we'd find out who really doesn't want to work.
Right. I mean, because it would be available. But the other thing is, and this was extremely popular and the current idea in the 30s and the 40s, and politically was not difficult because people understood that you're generating wealth, that money doesn't get, those are jobs where people are earning money and spending it back into the economy. So it's generating economic development and it's generating economic growth.
Yeah, it runs counter to recession and depression conditions. Right. It's a great proposal. That's the other big idea that I've been trying to advance.
I've left you about a minute and a half, but I want to know about the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center, and you founded that in 2015. What have been maybe one of the big bright spots for you?
Wonderful staff and team. Gwen Wright, our administrative director, Joanne O'Neill, our grants manager, Salima El Amin, who heads our Global Inequality Research Initiative, Keisha Bentley Edwards, Bob Korstadt, and Derek Hamilton, who are the associate directors, Kai Zhao, who's our statistician, Mark Paul, who is a postdoctoral fellow, and Addison Malone, who is one of our research associates. They're phenomenal. We receive internal support from the Office of the Provost and from the Dean of Arts and Sciences, and we've gotten extramural funding from the Ford Foundation, National Science Foundation, the Kellogg Foundation. It's this team that makes it possible to pursue the kind of research investigations on wealth and inequality that I've undertaken. Couldn't do it alone.
We're happy you're doing it because we're always happy to have you on this show with your results. William Sandy Darity is an economist and scholar at Duke, directs the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity, and you can find out more about his work and the center at our website, stateofthings.org. Sandy, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
More about our show, stateofthings.org, a show that is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Sheldon Orman, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is the technical director, Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.